a non-Baha'i function related to his operations in the hall next Sunday night as a gesture of friendship with him. Today we had some sad news from Iran. The friends there, you know, have been going through a series of small difficulties. Some of the people who had been arrested in the past and were free had to report monthly to the authorities to just say where they were, what they were doing, and so on. And they've been doing this now for several years. As you know, the last martyrdom was in December. The news we had was in December 89. Now, recently, on one of these routine visits to the authorities, Bahman Samandari was detained. And there was no explanation given. This was just prior to Nowruz. No explanation was given. And he wasn't allowed to contact his wife, but when he didn't come home, she called and she heard that he'd been taken to Evin prison. Then she said, well, she wants to bring him some clothes or visit him or something. They said, well, this is the Nowruz season and the holiday come after 2 weeks. Well, this is, nothing has happened like that recently. So the house was alerted about this. Now, she finally went there now. They gave her a time to come. And when she went to take him his things, they delivered to her his will and said that he had been executed according to the verdict of the courts. So this is came as a rather thunderbolt today to the House of Justice. The situation has been improving steadily as far as this type of event. And we're seeking further confirmations about the details of it, because they have sometimes reported falsely executions just to and spook the family and so on. But it seems quite clear that that something has happened. As you know, the judiciary and judiciary ministry of justice there in Iran is under the influence of the fundamentalists, and there's another much more liberal approach in the prime minister's office and in that arena of activities, which has been working to avoid embarrassment for Iran in the public view around the world. This has acted as a protection for the Baha'i community. So we don't know whether this is an isolated thing or... Bahman was a very, very devoted, very fine Baha'i. Maybe some of you know Christine Hakim Samandari in Paris. This is her husband's brother. And he is a man, 40 maybe in his late 40s. His crime was that in 4 years ago, one of the Baha'i committees met in his home. He wasn't even a member of the committee, but he was there. And it's clear from the text of the will, the beginning of the text of the will, that he was given the choice of recanting or death. And he said, I've made my decision. There's no other right decision but this decision. Forgive me, he says to his wife and his children, for everything. So that you don't know what actually is going on there, but I wanted you to know about it, that news is spreading out in the World Center, and maybe you may hear from outside something, so you be aware of what's going on. He also asked for his body, and they said, no, well, generally they didn't give the bodies of the executed parties. She could inquire the central government if she wanted to, which is not very hopeful either, because usually that means that there may have been torture involved or something of the sort. Mr. Samandari has attained the goal we are all aiming at, not necessarily of martyrdom, but to try to attain God's good pleasure and to acquire those qualities which will allow us to draw closer to God, to be able to more incarnate in our lives those qualities and principles and attributes which will be a healing to others. In the process, we're reading this section on the true seeker. And you recall last week we were discussing this question of no remnant of either love or hate. Page 193. Baha'u'llah also emphasizes here that the importance of trust in God. How many times do we question what's happening to us? How many times do we rush to our prayer book because things are not going the right way? And yet we're praying all the time, we're asking God's assistance, but somehow we don't trust that it's getting through, or maybe we're not receptive to it, or whatever it is. But this question of contenting ourselves with that which God has ordained for us, trusting that God has a plan, has a purpose, if we are submitting ourselves willingly in the right spiritual attitude, we'll be moved through the stages and steps that He wants for us. And even the difficult things that befall us may be very important, that we trust that they have meaning for us, that they have the power to develop us. The seeds don't grow in the ground until the ground has been plowed. And hard ground is tough to plow. And the plow has to be pulled through it, and it has to crack and open, and then this dryness has to gradually be reduced and until it becomes soft. That sometimes takes some doing. And so it would seem that the conditions of our heart, which Baha'u'llah in this book likens to earth, need also to be plowed. And in the writings it says these tests are as plowing to the soul. After that, the seeds of the divine bestowals and the showers of His mercy and kindness rain upon this earth, soften it, and cause these hyacinths and the lilies of divine wisdom to blossom within our inner beings, and we discover these unseen, beautiful, miraculous, mysterious realities within us as an effect, as the effect of submitting ourselves to this process of plowing and seeking the bounties and the showers of God, and waiting patiently, trusting in the outcome, and not pulling the little plants up when they first come up to see what they are, letting things develop the way they're supposed to develop. He also says that must renounce the peoples of the earth and detach himself from the world of dust and cleave unto Him who is the Lord of Lords. Each one of those has wide range of meaning for us in our lives here. Humility, he must never seek to exalt himself above anyone, must wash away from the tablet of his heart every trace of pride and vainglory, must cling unto patience and resignation, observe silence, and refrain from idle talk. For the tongue is a smoldering fire, and excess of speech a deadly poison. Material fire consumeth the body, whereas the fire of the tongue devoureth both heart and soul. The force of the former lasteth but for a time, whilst the effects of the latter endure a century. Now, oftentimes you hear Baha'is, or even will remember ourselves, this passage and think it must be related to backbiting, whereas all of these strong things here so far are only referring to an excess of talk, too much speech. And yet he says that The tongue is a smoldering fire, and excessive speech, not evil speech, just excessive speech, is a deadly poison. Curious. And he says, the fire of the tongue devoureth both heart and soul. Material fire consumeth the body, but this tongue has the power to consume the heart and the soul. And the material fire lasteth but for a time. The effects of this other fire of the tongue can endure a century. Then he goes on, that seeker should also regard backbiting as a grievous error, because of the stage further, and keep himself aloof from its dominion, inasmuch as backbiting quencheth the light of the heart and extinguisheth the life of the soul. Again, this question of trust in another form now, contentment, be content with little, be freed from all inordinate desire. Treasure the companionship of those that have renounced the world, and regard avoidance of boastful and worldly people a precious benefit. Question of praying at dawn. He gives this admonition about at the dawn of every day he should commune with God and with all his soul persevere in the quest of his beloved. That he should consume every wayward thought with the flame of his loving mention, and with the swiftness of lightning pass by all else save him. Now, this loving mention here, of course, in Persian is zekr. It's the praise of God, or the mention of God, or the invocation of God, or the glorification of God, if you will. All these things are implied in this term zekr, which here is the flame of his loving mention. If we have a thought that we don't think is appropriate, it's not a goodbye thought, it's a temptation or whatever it is, it comes in our mind and we see it setting there. Now, we want to get rid of it. We want to take it out of our mind, so to speak. We find it doesn't come out easily. It doesn't go. When you push it, it doesn't go. Baha'u'llah gives us a formula here. He says, consume it with the flame of his loving mention. In other words, you have to turn your attention to something else. You can't take what's in your mind and remove it and leave a vacuum. You have to put something positive in it. And as this is a shadowy remembrance, if it's, as he says here, a wayward thought, something of the darkness, the darker side of our personality, we bring the light of remembering God, even the greatest name, even Allah Abba, into the midst of that and move off of the influence of that thought. By the very fact that we are beings that have an animal part to us, we sometimes have temptations, or we have inordinate desires, or whatever we have. These things come to our minds in a natural way, but we shouldn't dwell on them. We shouldn't elaborate them. We shouldn't enhance them with our imagination, but rather turning away from them, turn to the remembrance of God. Seems to be the very central formula for how to cleanse our thoughts and our consciousness of things that shouldn't be in it. It can become such a second nature to us to do that, that even in dreams we will find ourselves using the greatest name to move away from things that are not acceptable, and to not use dreams as another way of fulfilling idle fancies and vain imaginings, simply because sometimes we're even conscious it's a dream and we say, well, this is a dream. He should succor the dispossessed and never withhold his favor from the destitute. He should show kindness to animals, how much more unto his fellow man, to him who is endowed with the power of utterance. One of these great distinguishing gifts of man, power of utterance. He should not hesitate to offer up his life for his beloved, nor allow the censure of the people to turn him away from the truth. He should not wish for others that which he doth not wish for himself, nor promise that which he doth not fulfill. With all his heart should the seeker avoid fellowship with evildoers and pray for the remission of their sins. He should forgive the sinful and never despise his low estate, for none knoweth what his own end shall be. How often hath the sinner at the hour of death attained to the essence of faith, and quaffing the immortal draught, hath taken his flight under the celestial concourse? And how often hath a devout believer at the hour of his soul's ascension been so changed as to fall into the nethermost fire? Our purpose in revealing these convincing and weighty utterances is to impress upon the seeker that he should regard all else beside God as transient, and count all things save him who is the object of all adoration as utter nothingness. We have this phrase, detach himself, we saw on the previous page here, detach himself from the world of dust. There's of course many passages related to this, but one that I wanted to mention is from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, where he explains the prerequisites of a detached soul. What are the conditions of a detached soul? He says that he should not seek out anything whatsoever or whatever for his own self in this swiftly passing life, but that he should cut the self away, that is, he should yield up the self and all its concerns on the field of martyrdom at the time of the coming of the Lord. And again, with respect to avoid fellowship with evildoers, this admonition also appears in the hidden words, and concerning the meaning of this subject of eschewing fellowship with evildoers or so on, Shoghi Effendi advised in a letter written on his behalf, "In the passage, eschew all fellowship with the ungodly," should you recall this from the hidden words, Persian hidden word number 33, Baha'u'llah means that we should shun the company of those who disbelieve in God and are wayward. Shun the company of those who disbelieve in God and are wayward. The word ungodly is a reference to such perverse people. You recall this, where he said, regard avoidance of boastful and worldly people as a precious benefit. Summing up, Baha'u'llah says in the middle of page 195, "These are among the attributes of the exalted and constitute the hallmark of the spiritually minded. They've already been mentioned in connection with the requirements of the wayfarers that tread the path of positive knowledge. When the detached wayfarer and sincere seeker hath fulfilled these essential conditions, then and only then can he be called a true seeker. Whensoever he hath fulfilled the conditions implied in the verse, whoso maketh efforts for us, he shall enjoy the blessing conferred by the words, in our ways shall we assuredly guide him." This path of positive knowledge is synonymous, positive knowledge, with certitude. Same concept. He mentions this one place earlier in the book. I don't know if I can put my hand right on it. Talks about this path of positive knowledge. it's not coming up easily here. In the glossary or in the concordance, you'll be able to find other references to this positive knowledge that's referred to here. It's been mentioned previously in the text, and it goes back to it. Do you have anything that you'd like to comment about or ask with relation to this passage? It's so celebrated. I think we've all seen it extracted from the Ikon and read it many times. It's a marvelous guide to what our spiritual conduct, spiritual behavior should be if we want to penetrate more and more to this, to the possibility of attaining to this gift of God, the hidden gift that Baha'u'llah speaks about in his prayers. One doesn't advance, we make efforts, if I understand correctly, we can prepare ourselves, we can be prepared, but the attainment itself is a grace from God, it's a gift that he passes to us. The point is, if we're living in this world and there's a beautiful meadow, and then up towards the end of the meadow there's a wall, and in this wall is a large portal, a large gate, door. And occasionally that door opens, and beyond it is a heavenly celestial garden. But it doesn't open very often, and the people who would like to get through it forget, or they say, well, it doesn't seem to be open now, and they get playing in the fields and doing other things, and then they're too far away when it opens to get there and get in for the brief spell it may open or close. It seems to me that these qualities are the ones that keep us vigilant at the threshold of the door, so that any time it opens you're prepared to go through, and you'll get in if you're there. If you're off somewhere else, you may miss it. How often it will open, under what conditions it will open in each of our individual lives, we don't know. But there seem to be times, we know it's the wish of God that be that. Maybe the preparedness inclines God to open it. But it's not that we can demand that it open because we've fulfilled the conditions. It doesn't work that way. Not a science in that sense. It depends upon the grace of God. It's always the grace of God. It's always the favor of God if this new life and such is bestowed upon us. In fact, there isn't anything we can do to merit it. But there's lots of things we can do to not merit it. I suppose, you know, again we're speaking about moderation, and this has to be balanced with Baha'u'llah's admonition to express loving kindness. Lots of times loving kindness is expressed through speech. And also Abdu'l-Bahá speaks about the science of sociability. There's a certain social grace that requires a certain amount of speech. Excess is what he's talking about here. Now, whether we fall silent in a dinner party and then somebody picks up the thing, if you find you've been saying too much, let someone else pick it up, that's all. And also, sometimes we just chatter away to have people's attention, you know. And it can become a habit that we don't realize we're doing it. It's always useful to reflect. Is what I'm saying of any use to the person I'm saying it to? Or is it just making me happy? Do I really need to explain all the things that I'm explaining because somebody asked, how are you, politely? You know, sometimes you ask people, how are you? And they say, oh, well, you don't know, last night, I don't know. And they go on and on and on. Of course, you feel for them, but You didn't expect this long explanation, you know. But of course, if somebody gives a long explanation, then we should also have the courtesy to hear it out and be sympathetic. But if we're the one giving the long explanation, we should think twice whether is this useful to whoever is hearing it. Can they do anything about it? Can they help me? Listen to ourselves one day, all day long. Try to keep your eye on your watch. See how much you talk in a day. And then come to a reckoning in the evening with your God, please. Bestowing and attracting the hearts of others. Well, we all know that. We all know people that move us that way, that have an effect of deepening us just by being with them, that in the sense that because of where they are, you want to be there too. I know the great influence that the hands of the cause that were traveling around when I was a new pioneer out in the field, you know. I was isolated for a while in Central America in Bluefields, in a kind of a sleepy tropical town in Nicaragua. And the first visitor that I had that came there, not that I ever expected that anybody would ever visit, but I was an isolated believer, and well, there was one person who had become a Baha'i in the meanwhile. I was in my early 20s, so I wasn't kind of attracting a whole community around me at that stage. You know, the people asked me if I was going to build a church or what was going to happen. The first visitor I had was Dr. J. Carey, the Hand of the Cause. Imagine. He came and he spent 3-4 days there. Now that was, I was taking care of him. I had to go bring food and little carry pots and stuff and bring to eat for him to eat and prepare water in buckets for him to bathe, and it was just that kind of a situation. It was not a modern situation. It was an old, big old house that was too expensive for anybody to buy, so I'd been able to rent it as a Baha'i center, and he stayed in that house. And he spoke about the days of the Guardian and so many beautiful things when he was there. Just poured it. I remember when he left, afterwards I felt like I was walking like him. I mean, actually, you know, that you want to absorb so much that afterwards you find your head is in a position that reminds you of his position, and you're walking, you know. You're just trying to be just like this person and stuff. And other hands of the cause came and visited that. And Mr. Olinga came. That was the great blessing in those days, to be out pioneering somewhere. Instead of seeing the hands of the cause in a meeting with 1,000 other people, you were their host. And except for the time of the meetings, you were with them all the time, generally, unless they told you to go away so they could sleep or something. It was wonderful things. This is the thing that, you know, as we get older in the cause, we have to try to so improve our character that we can help the newer believers and give them an idea of what should maturity in the cause be, what is spiritual maturity. And Abdu'l-Bahá talks about it. He says, when we attain to spiritual maturity, each day will become as a year was before, when we think of the quantity and quality of the discoveries the soul will make. Well, you can imagine. Look at this passage we just read. Gazing with the eye of God, he will perceive within every atom a door that leadeth him to the stations of absolute certitude. He will discover in all things the mysteries of divine revelation. read with the eye of God the meaning and purpose of things. Now, even if we just had a flash of it once or twice in our life, I think it would, you know, keep us alive and going. We're moving in this direction. This is what our goal is. In various activities, you see, then he say, okay, I want you, I'll come for you. This is kind of a heavy image that the falcon's going to get you, but if you're gotten by that divine falcon, that's what you want. Maybe your mouse-like self will die then. You'll become a new creation. Well, by having the lights go off, we've done less reading tonight. That's very good. We still have some more to go with this section on the city of God. We'll read another passage, maybe, and then we'll finish for this evening. The bottom of page 196. I swear by God, were he that treadeth the path of guidance and seeketh to scale the heights of righteousness, to attain unto this glorious and supreme station, he would inhale at a distance of 1,000 leagues the fragrance of God, and would perceive the resplendent morn of a divine guidance rising above the dayspring of all things. This seems to be also an allusion again to his own revelation, the dawning of his own revelation. Each and everything, however small, would be to him a revelation leading him to his beloved, the object of his quest. So great shall be the discernment of this seeker that he will discriminate between truth and falsehood, even as he doth distinguish the sun from shadow. If in the uttermost corners of the east the sweet savors of God be wafted, he will assuredly recognize and inhale their fragrance, even though he be dwelling in the uttermost ends of the west. He will likewise clearly distinguish all the signs of God, his wondrous utterances, his great works and mighty deeds. Here he defines some of the signs of God. From the doings, words, and ways of men, even as the jeweler who knoweth the gem from the stone, or the man who distinguisheth the spring from autumn and heat from cold. When the channel of the human soul is cleansed of all worldly and impeding attachments, it will unfailingly perceive the breath of the beloved across immeasurable distances, and will, led by its perfume, attain and enter the city of certitude. Therein he will discern the wonders of his ancient wisdom, and will perceive all the hidden teachings from the rustling leaves of the tree which flourisheth in that city. With both his inner and his outer ear, he will hear from its dust the hymns of glory and praise ascending unto the Lord of Lords. And with his inner eye will he discover the mysteries of return and revival. How unspeakably glorious are the signs, the tokens, the revelations, the splendors, which he who is the king of names and attributes hath destined for that city. The attainment of this city quencheth thirst without water and kindleth the love of God without fire. Within every blade of grass are enshrined the mysteries of an inscrutable wisdom, and upon every rose bush a myriad nightingales pour out in blissful rapture their melody. Its wondrous tulips unfold the mystery of the, and there's an insert here, of the undying fire in the burning bush. And its sweet savors of holiness breathe the perfume of the messianic spirit. It bestoweth wealth without gold and conferreth immortality without death. In every leaf, ineffable delights are treasured, and within every chamber, unnumbered mysteries lie hidden. They that valiantly labor in quest of God's will, when once they have renounced all else but Him, will be so attached and wedded to that city that a moment's separation from it would to them be unthinkable. They will hearken unto the infallible proofs from the hyacinth of that assembly and receive the surest testimonies from the beauty of its rose and the melody of its nightingale. Once in about 1,000 years shall this city be renewed and re-adorned. And the last part of this section from the Gleanings, these are parts of these have all been cited in the Gleanings, about halfway down the page. That city is none other than the Word of God revealed in every age and dispensation. In the days of Moses, it was the Pentateuch. In the days of Jesus, the Gospel. In the days of Muhammad, the Messenger of God, the Quran. In this day, the Bayan, and in the dispensation of Him whom God will make manifest His own book, the book unto which all the books of former dispensations must needs be referred, the book which standeth amongst them all transcendent and supreme. And Shoghi Effendi on page 315 or something like that. Hold on a second. Page 215 of God Passes By says that this passage here is an allusion to the Kitab-i Aqdas, the book of Him whom God shall make manifest, is specifically that. And he says, this is the book under which all the books of former dispensations must needs be referred, the most holy book, the book which standeth amongst them all transcendent and supreme. Well, there's a few little things. We'll go back to points here, the 1,000 years and so on, when we take this up again. We'll start reading from page 200.